some movies are beloved from day one. Some movies take years to find their audience. And some movies crash, burn, and spend decades being called a disaster before people finally start to realize, wait a minute, was this actually brilliant? This is Dune. No, not that Dune. The weird one. The one where Patrick Stewart charges into battle with a pug. The one where Sting randomly shows up in a metal Speedo like he got lost on his way to a rock concert. The one where David Lynch took a massive, complex, deeply philosophical sci-fi epic and somehow made it feel like a 2-hour-long fever dream. It was hated. It flopped. Even Lynch himself disowned it. But I love it. And today, we're going deep. You're listening to Rewind or Die. My name is Adam. Let's talk David Lynch's Dune from 1984.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected...
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown, an incredible secret has been kept on this planet. And the unbelievable meet.
I see two great houses. Feeding.
Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves.
We have worm sign, the likes of which even God has never seen.
And skies are filled with fire.
The prophecy which will cleanse the universe and bring us out of darkness.
Where a young warrior is called upon to free his people. A world that holds creation's greatest treasure.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
And greatest terrors. A world where the mighty...
This is genocide. The deliberate and systematic destruction of all life on Arrakis.
The mad...
I will kill him!
I will love you forever.
And the magical...
Father, the sleeper has awakened!
...will have their final battle.
Long live the fighters! Do not show the slightest pity or mercy! Emperor, we come for you!
A spectacular journey through the wonders of space and the mysteries of time. From the boundaries of the incredible to the borders of the impossible. Now, Frank Herbert's widely read, talked about, and cherished masterpiece comes to the screen. Dino De Laurentiis presents Dune, a world beyond your experience. Beyond your imagination.
All right, so let's talk about this version of Dune. It's 1984. This is a movie that wasn't just ignored when it came out. It was actively rejected. It flopped. It got torn apart by critics. And even David Lynch, the guy who made it, wanted nothing to do with it. And yet, I love it. Not in an ironic... oh, it's a fun train wreck kind of way. I genuinely think this movie rules. It's bold, bizarre, visually stunning, and an adaptation of a book that should have been impossible to film in the first place. Now, I know this version of Dune has gotten more love over the years. There's a cult following now. Some people are starting to come around to the idea that maybe, just maybe, this movie is kind of great. And last year... Blank Check did an entire Lynch mini-series and covered Dune beautifully. If you haven't heard those episodes, go listen to them. They covered Lynch's entire career in a way that, honestly, I couldn't do better. but I still wanted to talk about Dune. Because when it comes to Lynch, this was my entry point, how I discovered Dune. See, when I was a kid, I had no idea this movie was considered a flop. I thought it was a huge sci-fi classic, right up there with Star Wars and Blade Runner, because that's how it felt when I first saw it. I walked into a video store. Yes, I'm that old. And I saw that legendary cover. Paul Atreides standing on a desert planet, an entire fleet of spaceships behind him, and the tagline, "A world beyond your experience, beyond your imagination." How do you not rent that? So I took it home, popped it in, and what I got was not Star Wars. It was something weirder, a world that felt oppressive, grimy, and dreamlike all at once. A sci-fi universe that wasn't about cool space battles, but about prophecy, religion, and giant worms that eat entire cities. And a lead character who wasn't just the chosen one. He was the chosen one of a galaxy-wide conspiracy where people had been literally breeding him into existence for thousands of years. I was hooked. But the weird thing was, nobody else seemed to love this movie. People knew about it. People had opinions. But it was either, oh yeah, that weird mess, or you should just read the book instead. And I get it. This version of Dune is not an easy watch. It's dense as hell. It throws entire paragraphs of exposition at you every 5 minutes. And it's got some deeply strange artistic choices, including, but not limited to, whispered inner monologues played completely straight, a grotesque floating space baron covered in sores. Patrick Stewart charging into battle with a pug under his arm. And of course, Sting in a metal Speedo, glowering at the camera like he's about to drop a prog rock album. So yeah, it's a lot. Why I think this movie deserves another chance. But here's the thing. Lynch made a sci-fi epic that feels like nothing else before or after it. And if this movie had been a smash hit instead of a total failure, we'd be talking about it completely differently today, which is why I think it's time for people to give this movie another chance. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying it's even the best Dune adaptation. Denis Villeneuve exists, and I am not here to disrespect that man. But Lynch's Dune is a fascinating, flawed, hypnotic piece of sci-fi history, and I think, decades later, it deserves more love. And speaking of people who love Dune, there was no way I was getting through this episode without Jeff jumping in. This man could not physically allow me to cover Lynch or Dune without forcing his way into the studio. So, here we go. Jeff, come on in. Let's talk about the most infamous disaster of David Lynch's career and why we both kind of love it anyway. We were always going to cover this version of Dune at some point, but now it just feels right. Because David Lynch, one of the greatest, strangest, most uncompromising filmmakers to ever live, is gone. And I needed to do this episode because if there was ever a film that summed up everything that made Lynch brilliant, frustrating, impossible, and kind of hilarious, it's this version of Dune. Now, I couldn't do this alone. Because if I'm going to get through the production disaster that was Lynch's doomed sci-fi epic, I need backup. Someone who understands the genius, the chaos, and who has absolutely no patience for me pretending this is a misunderstood masterpiece. Jeff.
I still don't know how I got roped into this.
You got roped in because you are the only person I know who has read Dune multiple times, loves Lynch, and still somehow thinks this movie is a disaster.
Because it is.
You say that, but I feel like there's a small part of you that admires it.
Yeah. The part of me that enjoys watching a train derail in slow motion.
See? That's something.
Adam, I just need to point out something. You have covered Demolition Man and Sudden Death on this podcast. And now, suddenly, it's time for an emotional tribute to David Lynch?
Yeah, because I contain multitudes.
What are your next two movies, huh? Rollerball and Citizen Kane?
Okay. First of all, Rollerball rules. Second, don't tempt me. I could absolutely do Citizen Kane and find a way to connect it to Jean-Claude Van Damme.
I don't doubt it. And that's what worries me.
Look, I had to do this episode because Lynch's career was full of uncompromising vision, surrealist nightmares, and hypnotic dream logic. And this version of Dune? This was the one time Hollywood tried to shove all of that into a blockbuster and immediately regretted it.
Yeah, because it didn't work. And Lynch knew it. He spent his entire career pretending this movie didn't exist.
And that's the tragedy, because it could have been something incredible. And that's why we need to talk about how this happened. How did we get to a world where David Lynch, the David Lynch, was directing a massive sci-fi epic for Dino De Laurentiis?
And even crazier, how did we almost live in a world where David Lynch directed Return of the Jedi? Yeah, let's start there. Because before he got dragged into Dune, Lynch was actually approached by George Lucas to direct Return of the Jedi.
Which is completely insane.
It is. But here's the thing. Lucas was a fan. He saw Eraserhead and The Elephant Man, and for some reason, he thought, yeah, this guy should wrap up my family-friendly space opera.
Okay, first of all, wild choice. But second, I would give anything to see Lynch's version of Return of the Jedi.
Same. But it was never going to happen. Apparently, Lucas invited Lynch to Skywalker Ranch, gave him the full pitch, and Lynch was deeply uncomfortable the entire time.
Which tracks. Because Lynch did not do well with creative control being taken away.
Exactly. And Lucas had no intention of letting a director actually direct. He wanted a hired gun to execute his vision. And Lynch was like, nope, absolutely not.
So instead of getting David Lynch's weird, nightmarish vision of the Star Wars universe, we got David Lynch directing Dune instead. And somehow, it went even worse. So here's what happened. After he turned down Return of the Jedi, Lynch got a call from Dino De Laurentiis. De Laurentiis had the rights to Dune, and he needed a director who could make it his next big sci-fi hit. And naturally, he thought, the guy who made Eraserhead, perfect fit for a massive studio blockbuster. Which is so insane, because Lynch had never even read Dune before.
I love that. Imagine someone walking up to you and going, hey, we need someone to direct The Lord of the Rings. Have you read it? And you just go, nah, but I'll figure it out.
And at first, Lynch was actually excited. He saw the potential. He wanted to make it his. But then, the studio happened. De Laurentiis was not going to let Lynch be Lynch. This wasn't going to be his surrealist dreamscape. This was going to be a commercial science fiction tentpole. And as soon as production started, Lynch started losing control. And this is where the tragedy of this version of Dune really sets in. Because this movie could have been something incredible if they had just let him cook. But they didn't. Every creative decision he tried to make, shot down. Every attempt at making this story his own, shut down. The studio wanted a Star Wars-level blockbuster. Lynch wanted to make an atmospheric, dreamlike, psychological sci-fi epic. And neither of those things were going to work together. So instead, we got The Compromise from Hell. A movie that feels like half of a David Lynch film and half of a studio Frankenstein project.
Which is why it doesn't work.
Or why it works in a completely unique, completely insane way.
You are incapable of just admitting that this movie is bad.
It's not bad. It's a fascinating failure.
It's the best possible bad adaptation.
See? This is what I mean. Instead of just saying, yeah, it's a disaster, you come up with wild excuses like best possible bad adaptation.
Because it is. It's a disaster, but it's also incredible.
Jesus Christ. All right. We've set the stage. Now let's get into the absolute chaos that was making this version of Dune. Studio interference, massive rewrites, and the most cursed marketing campaign of all time.
Oh, this is going to be painful.
All right. So we've set the stage. We've covered how Lynch got roped into this, how he had never read Dune before taking the job, how he turned down Return of the Jedi to do this instead. And how literally no one involved seemed to know what kind of movie they were actually making. But now, let's talk about the actual production. Because, oh my God.
Yeah. This wasn't just a difficult shoot. This was a full-blown Hollywood disaster. This is a movie where everything that could go wrong absolutely did.
This production was so cursed that if you told me the set was built on top of an ancient Fremen burial ground, I would believe you.
And it wasn't even shot on a soundstage in Hollywood. They filmed it in Mexico.
Which, first of all, why?
Because it was cheaper. De Laurentiis wanted a massive, sprawling sci-fi epic on a budget.
And, shocker, it backfired spectacularly. Because Mexico City? Not exactly built for making a giant Hollywood sci-fi epic.
All right, let's go down the list of things that went catastrophically wrong.
The heat was unbearable. It was bad. Cast and crew passing out on set, kind of bad. The power kept going out because they were trying to run Hollywood-level special effects on third-world electrical infrastructure. Half the cast and crew got sick from bad food and water. The production went wildly over schedule because nobody could figure out how to actually film a sci-fi epic in these conditions. Oh, and let's not forget the sheer level of chaos happening behind the camera, because David Lynch did not like this experience at all.
Right. This was the first and last time Lynch ever worked on a blockbuster. And from day one, he lost control of the movie.
Imagine you're David Lynch. You've just made The Elephant Man. You're feeling good. You're thinking, all right, I can do this. I can handle a big movie. I'll make it weird. I'll make it hypnotic. I'll make it poetic.
And then you get to set and everything's on fire.
Right? You're standing there, covered in dust, drenched in sweat, watching a giant worm prop collapse in real time, and some studio executive is yelling, "Make it look like Star Wars."
And Lynch is just standing there thinking, "I made a terrible mistake."
The studio interference was next level bad.
All right, so let's talk about how much control Lynch actually had.
Because the answer is none. Less than none, negative control.
De Laurentiis had final say on everything. And when Lynch turned in his original cut of the movie, the studio freaked out.
Because it was way too long.
Yeah, 4 hours.
4 hours. Look, I love this movie, obviously. But even I can admit, 4 hours of this would have broken people.
And not in a good way. Not in a Return of the King extended edition way.
No, in a people would have walked out of the theater questioning their life choices kind of way.
And the studio's response? They were like, great, we need this under 2 hours.
Which is an insane thing to do to Dune. Because if you've ever read Dune, you know that getting through that book in 2 hours is physically impossible.
It's like trying to condense Game of Thrones into a single episode.
So they chopped it up, they cut huge sections, they took entire character arcs and just threw them in the garbage. And then, because that wasn't confusing enough, they decided, hey, let's fix this by making every character whisper their inner thoughts directly to the audience.
Which is one of the wildest creative decisions in film history.
Oh my God, I love it so much. Every 5 minutes, someone stares blankly into the camera and we just hear an eerie whisper.
And not even useful information. He is the Kwisatz Haderach. My plan is coming together. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer.
Jeff, tell me this isn't the weirdest way to deliver exposition you've ever seen.
Dude, we get it.
Okay, but let's talk about the biggest star of the movie.
Paul Atreides?
Number the worms.
Oh, God.
Look, Dune is about the worms. If you screw up the worms, you screw up the whole movie. And in this version of Dune, the worms kind of rule.
They are simultaneously amazing and terrible.
Exactly. The design? Incredible. They look terrifying. They actually feel massive.
But then they start moving.
And suddenly, it's like someone's wiggling a giant sock puppet.
Right. They move like someone's got them on a string behind the camera.
Like a haunted carnival attraction.
Like an inflatable tube man trying his best.
And here's the thing. I don't care. The worms are awesome. Even when they move like drunk caterpillars, they are awesome. Final thoughts on the production nightmare. So just to recap, they filmed this in a place that actively tried to kill them. Lynch had zero control. The studio chopped the movie into nonsense. The whisper monologues were a bold yet baffling choice. And the sandworms look both terrifying and like they need a nap.
So basically, this movie was doomed from the start.
Or it was destined to be a misunderstood masterpiece.
Jesus Christ, we're never going to agree on this, are we?
Nope. All right, up next, we need to talk about the cast. We'll be right back after these messages.
Dino De Laurentiis presents Dune. A world where the mighty, the mad.
All I can see is an Atreides that I want to kill.
And the magical.
The sleeper has awakened!
Will have their final battle. A world called Dune.
Long live the fighters!
Dune, rated PG-13. Starts Friday at select theaters.
All right, we've covered the Curse production. We've covered how Lynch had zero control. We've covered the Whisper monologues, the drunk caterpillar worms, and the fact that this movie was basically doomed from the start. But now we need to talk about the cast, because this movie is stacked, and not in a normal way. This isn't like, oh, look at this well-assembled Hollywood ensemble. No, this cast is insane. It is a mix of brilliant character actors, legendary stage performers, people who had no idea what they signed up for, and one very sweaty Sting.
Yeah, let's just get this out of the way right now. Sting is in this movie.
And not just in it. He is in a metal Speedo, standing in a cloud of steam, glaring at the camera like he's about to drop the wildest concept album of his career.
Like, why is he even here?
Because Dino De Laurentiis took one look at Dune and thought, you know what this needs? A rock star in a loincloth.
And honestly, not wrong.
No notes. Perfect decision. But let's start with our hero, our chosen one. Kyle MacLachlan plays Paul Atreides, a role that requires him to be a noble warrior, a messianic figure, and also completely dead inside. And Kyle MacLachlan is too nice for this.
Yeah, I love Kyle. He's one of the most likable actors of all time. He's charming, he's weird, he can do the eerie Lynch thing better than anyone. But in this movie, he looks so confused.
Like someone just told him he's playing Hamlet, but they won't let him read the script.
Like he wandered onto the set thinking it was a historical drama, and then suddenly someone handed him a laser gun and said, "Kill the Emperor."
Kyle's whole vibe in this movie is, I guess I'm here now.
Which honestly is how most people experience Dune for the first time.
All right, let's talk about Patrick Stewart. Because why is he in this?
I'll never complain about Captain Picard showing up anywhere. But dude, he had no idea what this movie even was, it feels like. His acting style isn't exactly out of place. It just feels like he's in a different movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. He has admitted in interviews that he did not understand the script and just kind of went for it.
And yet, he commits so hard.
Like, this man plays Gurney Halleck like he's doing Shakespeare in a burning building.
My favorite part, he goes into battle holding a pug.
Yes. He is charging into war with a dog. Like he's saying, this is not just my war pug, this is my emotional support pug.
Imagine being on set that day, just standing there while Patrick Stewart, holding a pug, screams about vengeance while lasers go off behind him.
And Lynch is just behind the camera, whispering cryptic riddles to himself.
And Kyle MacLachlan is somewhere off screen, trying to figure out what his motivation is.
All right, now we have to talk about the most deranged performance in this entire movie.
Which is saying something.
I present to you Kenneth MacMillan as Baron Harkonnen.
This is one of the most disgusting, over-the-top, unhinged villains I have ever seen.
The man is floating. He is cackling. He is covered in boils. He is screaming at all times.
And then, for some reason, he just starts bleeding uncontrollably at random intervals.
Like, what is happening?
Dude, he is not playing a villain. He is playing a haunted house attraction that somehow became sentient.
I feel like Lynch gave him zero direction. He just said, be as gross as possible.
And he said, say no more.
All right, now let's talk about a man who deserved better. Max von Sydow, a legendary actor, a cinematic titan, a man who played chess with death in The Seventh Seal, is in this movie. And I have never seen a man look more like he's thinking, I regret this immediately in my life.
He looks like he's counting the minutes until he can go home.
Like, he took this role because he thought, ah, yes, science fiction. That's respectable. And then he saw the floating Baron and realized he made a huge mistake.
Dude is trying so hard to give a dignified performance, and everyone around him is whispering their inner thoughts into the void.
I imagine his contract said he had to stay, but his soul left 3 days into shooting. Oh, this cast. So, let's review. Kyle MacLachlan is too sweet for this movie. Patrick Stewart brought a pug to war. Sting is just here to be hot and angry. The Baron is a nightmare. Max von Sydow is doing his best, and it's not enough. And somehow, all of this just adds to the experience.
It's like they all signed up for completely different movies.
Which, honestly, makes it even better. All right, when we come back, we're talking about the ending. The most rushed, nonsensical, insane climax in science fiction history. A literal rain dance. A fight that lasts 2 seconds. And a final line so baffling that even Lynch was like, yeah, I had nothing to do with that.
I am so ready for this. Wait, Adam, are you trying to be funny now? Because this was actually funny.
Oh, what? I'm not allowed to be funny?
No, I just assumed all your jokes were unintentional.
Wow. Wow. I invite you on my show, and this is how you repay me?
Just saying. Maybe this Dune episode won't be a total disaster after all.
Oh, it's going to be a disaster, but a beautiful one, like Dune. All right, we have arrived. We have reached the final act of this cinematic fever dream. And if you thought the first 2 hours of this movie were confusing, rushed, and borderline nonsensical, I have fantastic news. Because the ending of this version of Dune is one of the most rushed, chaotic, incomprehensible third acts I have ever seen in my life.
It's like they realized they only had 20 minutes left and just started cramming in plot points like they were stuffing a suitcase at the airport.
Oh, it's worse than that. It's like they skipped the last 200 pages of the book, skimmed a Wikipedia summary, and just started making stuff up.
I mean, let's be real. Nobody involved actually understood Dune.
Exactly. And instead of taking their time and letting the climax build, they go full speedrun mode.
It's an absolute disaster.
No, it's cinema.
Oh my God.
Step one, Paul becomes a god in like 5 seconds. All right, so we kick off the finale with Paul Atreides fully embracing his destiny. Now, in the book, this takes a long time. There's development, there's struggle, there's inner conflict. Paul has to earn his place among the Freemen. But in the movie, Paul just drinks some spicy blue space juice and instantly becomes a god.
Yeah, no buildup, no hesitation, no second guessing. He just slams back one sip of psychedelic sandworm Kool-Aid and boom, he's the Messiah.
I mean, have you ever had a really strong energy drink?
Yeah, but I don't immediately develop cosmic powers and start whispering prophecy.
The power of the Kwisatz Haderach surges within me. Also, my hands are shaking and my heart is going 1,000 miles an hour.
Paul Atreides just slammed the equivalent of 4-bang energy drinks, and now he's ready to kill a space emperor.
So Paul becomes Super Saiyan Paul, and immediately we cut to war. The Fremen just instantly take over Arrakis.
Yeah, this is a full-blown planetary revolution, and it happens in like 2 minutes.
The actual battle, it lasts about as long as a Taco Bell drive-thru order.
There's no tension, there's no strategy, there's just Paul yelling, "Attack!" and then a bunch of laser beams go off.
It's a montage of explosions, people falling over, and sandworms casually rolling into frame like, hey, what's up? What are we doing? Now, in a normal movie, when the hero faces the main villain, it's a big climactic duel. But in this version of Dune, Paul fights Sting for exactly 20 seconds.
Dude, this is the most anticlimactic fight scene ever filmed.
Paul walks into the Emperor's palace, calls out Fade Rautha, and then just kills him instantly.
Sting shows up looking pissed off. They lock blades for maybe 4 moves, and then Paul just stabs him and it's over.
It's like if Rocky fought Ivan Drago and won in the first round.
It's so bad.
No, it's amazing.
Adam, this is the villain they've been building up for the entire movie, and he goes down like a chump.
Yeah, but it's Sting. It's the funniest possible way for him to go out.
I can't believe you defend this movie.
All right, now we have arrived. Because after the fastest war in cinematic history and the easiest final boss fight ever, Paul walks out and delivers the final line of the movie. And it is so bad, it's one of the most baffling final lines of all time, because it literally makes no sense. So Paul stands there victorious, having become the prophesied Messiah, and he says, "He is the Kwisatz Haderach, and now he will make it rain." And then it just starts raining.
Dude, that is not how Dune works.
It is not how Dune works.
They just made up an ending. They just went, screw it. Paul can summon rain now. I'm just picturing a producer dramatically ripping the pages out of the Book of Dune behind the camera and replacing it with one word, rain.
Paul just activates his God mode cheat code, and suddenly the desert planet is Seattle. Dude, Arrakis is not supposed to have rain. This undoes the entire ecosystem of the book. Yeah, but Hollywood needed a big, dramatic moment, so they just went full, main character gets to control the weather now.
And then boom, smash cut, credits.
No explanation, no epilogue, no wrap-up, just rain.
And Lynch has disowned this movie ever since.
And I will defend it. All right, so let's review then. Paul drinks one sip of Space Gatorade and instantly becomes a god. The Freemen take over an entire planet in under 3 minutes. Paul fights Sting for about as long as it takes to microwave a Hot Pocket. And then Paul just makes it rain because the movie needed an ending.
This is the laziest, most rushed ending I have ever seen in a major sci-fi film.
Which is why it's amazing. I am in pain. All right, next up, we're talking Legacy. Because somehow this mess of a movie went from huge flop to cult classic. And now, thanks to Denis Villeneuve, Dune is actually mainstream.
Oh, I have thoughts on this. Hold on, Adam. What was that?
What was what?
The way you said cinema earlier.
Oh, sorry. Cinema.
Yeah, never do that again.
Oh, I'm doing it for every episode now.
I hate this.
Cinema.
Now, for the first time ever, Dune, featuring 50 minutes of never-before-seen footage. Starring Sting, Sean Young, and Star Trek's Patrick Stewart.
This is genocide, the deliberate and systematic destruction of all life.
The legendary planet holds the galaxy's greatest secret, Dune.
Long live the fighters!
Now, with never-before-seen footage, coming next month from Universal Pictures' debut network.
All right, we've made it through the cursed production. We've broken down the completely chaotic editing. We've examined the cast, the whisper monologues, and the tragic, hilarious disaster that is the final 20 minutes. And yet, somehow, this version of Dune survived. Because let's be real, this movie should have been forgotten. It should have been buried in the whoops that happened section of sci-fi history. It should have been a cautionary tale about what happens when you take an avant-garde filmmaker and force him to make a blockbuster. But instead, it became a cult classic.
Which is insane, because this movie was a huge flop when it came out.
Oh, huge, like Titanic levels of sinking.
Critics hated it. Audiences did not get it. And even people who loved sci-fi were like, what the hell did I just watch?
And you know what? That's fair. So it bombed. Hard. All right, let's talk numbers.
Dune had a $40 million budget. It made $30 million worldwide. That's a loss, a massive loss.
It got crushed, absolutely buried. The studio thought they had the next Star Wars. What they got instead was a two-hour whispering fever dream about space worms and royal intrigue that nobody understood.
And the reviews were brutal. Roger Ebert gave it one star, called it incomprehensible. The New York Times said it was visually impressive but completely nonsensical. Even people who loved David Lynch were like, dude, what happened?
Meanwhile, Lynch himself was already halfway out the door. He refused to do the director's cut, disowned the movie, and basically never spoke of it again.
And honestly, I don't blame him. The studio tore his vision apart.
Yeah, but this is where things get weird. Because despite being a total failure, despite getting destroyed by critics, despite the movie literally making no sense in its theatrical form, it didn't go away. And this is where my people come in. The video store weirdos. The kids who rented whatever looked cool on the box. The people who had no idea what they were getting into, but loved sci-fi so much that they'd watch anything. Because let me tell you, this movie thrived in the weird dark corners of video stores.
Oh yeah, because the cover was amazing.
Yes, the box art, incredible. A giant space worm looming in the background. Kyle MacLachlan, looking dramatic. I love the tagline, a place beyond your dreams, a movie beyond your imagination.
Jeff.
Which is hilarious because neither of those things are true.
Absolutely. It's beyond comprehension. But here's the thing. Kids who grew up watching sci-fi in the 80s and 90s, they found this movie and they didn't care that it was a mess. They saw weird space politics, blue-eyed desert warriors, giant worms, and Sting looking insane, and they were in.
And this is why it stuck around. Because once something gets a cult audience, it never truly dies.
Step three. The sci-fi fans started defending it. Like, people who had read the book. People who knew this was a terrible adaptation. Started saying, you know what? This movie kind of rules.
Which is insane. Because this is not a faithful adaptation.
Oh, not even close. But you know what it is? Visually stunning. Incredibly ambitious. Unlike anything else ever made. And when you have a big, bold, weird movie that looks cool, people are going to find something to love in it.
Even if it makes no sense.
Especially if it makes no sense. And here's the thing. Before 2021, people thought Dune was unfilmable.
Every attempt to adapt it had gone horribly wrong. Jodorowsky tried in the 70s, and it collapsed before they could shoot a frame. Lynch tried in the 80s, and the studio butchered it. The sci-fi miniseries in 2000 happened, and for decades, people just assumed, yeah, Dune is impossible.
And then Denis Villeneuve walked in and went, hold my spice.
And he did it. He made a version that wasn't just watchable. It was incredible.
And it did something even crazier. It made people go back and watch Lynch's Dune.
Which is insane.
But also hilarious. So let's recap. This movie bombed so hard it nearly ended Lynch's Hollywood career. It was a total disaster. And yet, it refused to die because science fiction fans kept it alive. The VHS weirdos kept it alive. And then 40 years later, Denis Villeneuve swooped in and made Dune cool. And now, Lynch's Dune isn't just a forgotten flop. It's a cult classic.
And that, my friend, is the power of nerds refusing to let go of something.
Absolutely. All right. Up next, we're making it official. We're talking Rewind or Die Hall of Fame.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Does everything just go into this Hall of Fame?
It's an exclusive club, Jeff.
You put sudden death in there.
I stand by that. All right. We have failed as podcasters.
I mean, broadly speaking, yes.
No, I mean today. Because we have spent this entire episode talking about David Lynch's Dune. We have covered everything from the cursed production to the whisper monologues to Sting being sweaty and shirtless for no reason. And we didn't talk about the soundtrack.
Oh, that's on us. That's a massive oversight.
Because, my friends, this movie's score is done by Toto.
Yes, that Toto. Not a classical composer, not an avant-garde synth wizard, not a big-name film scorer like John Williams or Jerry Goldsmith. Nope, the guys who wrote Africa.
And they killed it. How the hell did Toto end up scoring Dune?
Okay, let's back up, because this shouldn't have happened. Back in the early 80s, if you were making a big, expensive sci-fi epic, you didn't call a rock band to do the score. You called someone like John Williams or Ennio Morricone.
But Dino De Laurentiis, the chaos gremlin of Hollywood, thought, no, and let's bring in Toto.
And somehow this completely ridiculous decision worked.
Because this soundtrack rules. It is sweeping. It is massive. It is way more cinematic than it has any right to be. They could have just phoned in a bunch of generic synth-heavy 80s sci-fi music, but instead, they fully committed.
Yeah, they orchestrated the hell out of this thing. It's big, operatic, booming sci-fi majesty. They've got blaring horns, ethereal choral chants, dramatic drum sections. It's basically Lawrence of Arabia meets heavy prog rock.
And then, to make things even weirder, they bring in Brian Eno to write the main theme.
Yeah, because why not?
Toto does 95% of the score. And then for the big main theme of Dune, they call in Brian freaking Eno.
And Eno, being Eno, composes a haunting, hypnotic, dreamlike theme that is so good, it feels like it was written by an actual space god.
Honestly, that one track alone makes this one of the greatest sci-fi scores ever. Why this score still holds up.
Here's the crazy part. People might not remember the movie, but they remember this score. David Lynch's Dune has a reputation for being a disaster, but this soundtrack, people still talk about it.
Because it's weirdly timeless. Most 80s sci-fi scores sound very 80s. Lots of synths, drum machines, electronic warbling.
But this?
This is a full-scale, classical, orchestral score, with just enough rock influence to give it some edge. No cheesy 80s synths, no dated drum loops, just pure, massive space opera music.
And I would argue it's the best thing about this movie.
Oh, 100%. Even people who hate this movie admit the soundtrack is next level. Final thoughts. Toto didn't have to go this hard, but they did. So let's recap. A rock band was hired to score one of the most ambitious sci-fi movies ever made. They absolutely crushed it. Brian Eno randomly shows up to write a theme so good it should be in a museum. The score is now considered a cult classic, even by people who think the movie is nonsense.
And now you own this on vinyl, don't you?
Damn right I do.
That tracks.
This score deserves to be in the Sci-Fi Soundtrack Hall of Fame.
Oh my God, do you have a Hall of Fame for everything now?
Look, if I can induct Kurt Russell into the Action Hero Hall of Fame next week, I'll die happy.
You have a sickness.
And I wouldn't change a thing. All right, now we're done talking about David Lynch's Dune.
Are you sure?
Adam?
Probably. Because this matters, it's time. We have reached the moment of truth, because every movie we cover has to answer the ultimate question. Does it belong in the Rewind or Die Hall of Fame? And I'm just going to say it right now. Yes, yes, it absolutely does.
No, it does not.
Yes.
It does not.
Yes, Jeff.
Adam, number, this movie is an unwatchable mess.
First of all, how dare you? Second of all, you cannot tell me this movie isn't legendary.
Oh, it's legendary. Legendary is one of the worst science fiction adaptations ever made.
And yet, it still rules.
Adam, this is not a good movie.
We don't put movies in the Hall of Fame because they're good.
That is a wild thing to say.
We put movies in the Hall of Fame because they are important, because they are unforgettable, because they refuse to die. And this version of Dune refuses to die. All right, let's start with the basics. Do people remember this movie? Yes. Can you show someone one frame of this film, and they immediately know what it is? Yes. Is it burned into our collective pop culture consciousness because of its sheer chaotic energy? Also, yes.
Adam, I remember car crashes too. That doesn't mean I want to experience them again.
And yet, you can't look away. All right, second question. Did this movie change cinema? And the answer is yes. It changed Lynch's career. It changed how Hollywood approached big sci-fi adaptations. It proved that even when a movie flops, it can still find an audience decades later.
Okay, but most of those are warnings, not achievements.
Yeah, but warnings matter. This movie paved the way for better sci-fi movies.
Like Blade Runner, a movie that flopped, was misunderstood, but actually deserved its legacy.
Exactly. This is the Blade Runner of movies that are still kind of bad.
That sentence physically hurts me.
All right, let's be real. Is this movie fun to discuss?
Oh, absolutely.
Right? You can talk about this movie forever. The production nightmare, the casting insanity, the whisper monologues, the fact that Paul wins by essentially speedrunning the entire last act.
The fact that it ends with Paul just making it rain like he unlocked a cheat code.
Exactly. Now, some movies are meant to be funny. And then there are movies that become funny over time. And this movie? Comedy gold.
Oh yeah, just not on purpose.
That's what makes it even better. Like, let's go down the list. Patrick Stewart running into battle holding a pug. Sting standing around shirtless and sweaty, saying literally nothing for half the movie. Baron Harkonnen just bleeding at random intervals for no reason. Paul Atreides unlocking God mode after drinking a single shot of spicy space juice.
And then winning the final battle in the time it takes to microwave a hot pocket.
This movie does not know what it is, but it is hilarious.
I will give you that.
All right, so let's look at the other movies we've inducted into the Hall of Fame. Terminator 2, a masterpiece. Evil Dead 2, incredible. Demolition Man, peak satire. Sudden Death, hockey. Die Hard, perfect. Now, you're telling me there's no room for this version of Dune?
Adam, you just compared Dune to Sudden Death.
And I stand by it. Because if this Hall of Fame is about movies that are unique, unkillable, and unforgettable, then Dune belongs here.
Jesus Christ.
So, final ruling. It is unforgettable. It is impossible to explain. It has a weirdly dedicated fan base. It bombed, but it survived. So, yes, it is in.
I deeply disagree, but I don't have the energy to fight you anymore.
That's as close to a win as I'm going to get.
Fine. Put it in the Hall of Fame. But just know, this is a terrible decision.
The best possible terrible decision.
Okay, that was kind of poetic.
Thank you. All right, Youp next. Producer Steve is about to absolutely lose his mind.
Oh, this is going to be good. All right, before we wrap this up, I need to ask you something.
Uh-oh. That's never a good sign.
I need to understand.
I feel like you're about to psychoanalyze me, and I don't like it.
Adam, what is this show?
A celebration of cinema?
No. What is the logic behind the movies you pick? Because I have now sat here and watched you cover Demolition Man, Sudden Death, Evil Dead 2, Terminator 2, and now David Lynch's Dune. And I cannot find a pattern.
Jeff, my friend, the pattern is chaos.
That is not an answer.
Okay, fine. Here's the deal. I pick movies that deserve a second life. Movies that are fun, weird, or unforgettable.
So you're telling me there's an equal level of artistic merit between David Lynch's Dune and Sudden Death?
Absolutely.
That is insane.
And yet here we are.
Okay, fine. Let's flip the script. If you're just going full chaos mode with your picks, what would I pick if I was in charge of the show?
Oh, excellent question. Yes, Jeff, what would you pick?
First of all, I'd go thematic.
Boring.
I would structure it so there's an actual arc to the movies we cover.
Sounds like homework.
For example, instead of bouncing from Jean-Claude Van Damme to David Lynch, I'd say, let's cover the evolution of a filmmaker.
Interesting. Go on.
Like, if we're talking about John Carpenter, we don't start with Big Trouble in Little China. We start with the beginning of his collaborations with Kurt Russell.
Oh, no.
So instead of whatever madness you were about to pull for next week's episode, how about we do the right thing and cover John Carpenter's escape from New York? You have no argument against this, do you?
You son of a bitch, I'm in. All right, folks. You heard it here first. Next episode, we're talking about John Carpenter's escape from New York.
The beginning of one of the greatest director-actor partnerships of all time.
The birth of Snake Plissken, a.k.a. what if Clint Eastwood was a post-apocalyptic trash gremlin?
And the movie that proved Kurt Russell wasn't just the guy from Disney's The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes.
Oh, I am so excited for this. Because look, we need to talk about John Carpenter and Kurt Russell. This director-actor duo is one of the best in film history. Carpenter saw something in Russell that nobody else did. And together, they gave us some of the coolest, weirdest, most badass movies ever made. And Kurt Russell, my guy. He's the ultimate cool dude. He can do action. He can do comedy. He can play heroes, villains, and guys who clearly do not care what's going on, but will still save the day anyway. He is my favorite movie star. Period.
You know, I thought I was throwing you off with this pick, but now I feel like I just gave you superpowers.
You absolutely did. We're talking Kurt Russell, John Carpenter, 1980s grit, and a movie that asks the question, what if America just turned Manhattan into a prison and then immediately regretted it?
I'm actually excited for once.
And that's the best endorsement I could ever hope for.
All right. I have a serious question.
Steve, buddy, I feel like you never like where these questions go.
Because they always end with me questioning reality.
Sounds like a you problem.
Why does every movie end up in the Hall of Fame?
Because they deserve it.
No, see, that's the problem. If everything gets in, then nothing means anything. At this point, I feel like you'd induct Howard the Duck if you could find a way to justify it.
I would not.
You would.
Okay, I might.
I knew it. All right, let's just get this over with. Adam, what did David Lynch's Dune make at the box office?
Let's talk hard numbers. Budget, $40 million. Total box office, $30 million. That's a loss, baby.
So, not just a flop, but a full-blown, career-wrecking disaster.
Correct.
This movie lost so much money that Lynch immediately bailed on Hollywood blockbusters and made Blue Velvet as an apology to himself.
And this is in the Hall of Fame.
Because it's legendary.
It lost $10 million.
Come on! In Hollywood, that's nothing.
Adam, I need you to go outside and experience reality.
All right, Steve, I gotta ask. You sat through all of this, but did you actually watch David Lynch's Dune?
Yes, unfortunately.
And?
It is a mess, even for the 80s, even for big-budget sci-fi.
I see. And what specifically didn't work for you?
Let me list just a few things. The pacing? Non-existent. The whisper monologues? Haunting and unnecessary. The ending? The worst thing I have ever seen in a big-budget movie.
That's a bold claim.
A claim I stand by.
Okay, so you're saying you didn't vibe with it?
Oh my God.
Steve, you should know by now. Adam is incapable of admitting defeat.
I'm aware. I just keep hoping. All right, I already know what's next because, unlike you, I actually pay attention.
Oh, so you admit it's a great pick?
I admit Jeff saved this show from your madness.
Thank you.
Because next up, we are finally covering a movie that makes sense. A movie that actually belongs here.
I mean, define makes sense.
It's Escape from New York.
See? Reasonable. A great movie, a movie that deserves respect.
A movie where Kurt Russell growls his way through a dystopian hellscape wearing an eye patch and punching people. I do admit that is awesome.
A movie that is the official beginning of the Carpenter-Russell cinematic takeover.
And that's why I'm excited. Because we're not just talking Escape from New York. We're talking about the Carpenter-Russell partnership and why Kurt Russell is my favorite.
Oh, great. So this will just be an hour of you ranting about why Russell should be in the Action Hero Hall of Fame?
That is exactly what's happening.
I mean, he's not wrong.
I hate this job.
And I love this show. All right. That's going to do it for David Lynch's Dune. A movie that, despite flopping so hard it nearly erased itself from Hollywood, is now officially in the Rewind or Die Hall of Fame.
Which remains a mistake.
A mistake he will never admit to.
Not in this lifetime. All right, Steve. Final thoughts.
I think this movie is a mess. I think it's a disaster. I think it's the reason David Lynch stopped returning studio executives' phone calls. And yet, I get it.
Oh?
Look, this is a big, weird, ambitious failure. And sometimes, people love those.
A very grudging acknowledgement.
I just need you two to admit something in return.
Never.
This movie is bad.
Say it, Adam. Say the words.
It's gloriously broken.
I hate you so much.
You know what, Steve? You've been through a lot. You sat through Dune. You sat through Demolition Man. You need a break.
Don't forget Sudden Death, but thank you.
Which is why I am officially proposing producer Steve Month.
What?
Oh, no.
No, no, no.
Yes, a whole month where you get to pick the movies.
Oh, so I get to pick?
Absolutely, whatever you want.
You're going to regret that.
Adam, this is the dumbest thing you've ever done.
I regret nothing. All right, but first, next episode, we are officially covering John Carpenter's Escape from New York.
The only correct choice.
A legitimate classic.
A Kurt Russell masterclass in cool.
The start of the Carpenter-Russell cinematic domination.
And the first of many times, Kurt Russell plays a scruffy, reluctant badass who doesn't want to be here but is going to do the job anyway.
Adam's actual hero.
Listen. If the world ever falls apart and we need a guy to rescue the president from a dystopian hellscape, I am not trusting anyone but Kurt Russell.
So that's what we're doing next. And then?
Then producer Steve Month begins.
And I am terrified. Oh, one more thing. Next episode, we are officially entering the Russell Sons. A deep dive into the golden era of Kurt Russell. The action, the attitude, the hair, the growl. And it all starts with Escape from New York. Buckle up.
you guys weren't kidding about producer Steve Month, right? Because I've already got a list.
Ha! Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I have waited so long for this. Hope you're ready.
Hey, thanks for listening to Rewind or Die. There's always a new episode every Monday, so don't miss out. Remember to subscribe on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Producer Steve hopes you have enjoyed this program.